All of these countries in Latin America must expend greater effort over the next several years in building sound and expanding economies. Their population is growing at the rate of 3.5 to 4% a year. Even if we do what we're doing now, we won't hardly hold even. We will just standardize the poverty which is there. We have to redouble our efforts, my fellow Americans. And they have to more than redouble theirs, maximize them 10 times. So they don't have any time to play soldier. Agricultural production alone must increase sevenfold to take care of the needs of the present population and the growing population, and a population that is growing at an unprecedented rate. Most Latin American countries depend on the sales of one or two commodities for their foreign exchange. The entire foreign exchange savings of any one of these countries can be eliminated overnight by a sudden drop in the prices of certain raw materials, such as tin, coffee, copper, bananas. Industry in these countries has to be diversified and expanded, and that requires capital. There isn't any money there for armament research, and fortunately, very little is being given to it, but arms programs promoted. These and other needs are priority items on the agenda for the Alliance for Progress. And the longer the list of problems, the more this observer is convinced that every penny spent for armaments in this particular area detracts from the solution of the critical economic and social tasks. Now, this area needs the United States, and we need them. Other areas are not so sure that they need us or want us. I suggest that we start doing something to improve the household of the Western Hemisphere. And we can do it. Now, these problems will not respond to a hasty piecemeal approach, which combines emergency economic aid. I call it checkbook diplomacy. It comes with a rich society. It's the way some people take care of their families. Just write out another check. She'll be all right. Just give the son another $500. He'll be all right. Buy her a new car. She'll be all right. Instead of it maybe spending a little time on love and attention and family relations. What I'm suggesting is that we'll have to approach this matter methodically, carefully, and by plans. What I'm advocating is a total approach, which will strike at the multiple ills afflicting Latin America and similar underdeveloped regions. Now, I've selected this area because it's still possible to do something here. I think 10 years ago, we ought to have tried the same thing in the Middle East. Instead of that, we decided to have a pact. And today there's a first-class armaments race on in the Middle East, and these impoverished countries are destroying themselves. And the whole world stands on the precipice of disaster because mankind thought it was more important to concentrate on getting arms into the hands of people that didn't know how to take care of them, but knew how to fight and how to kill. I digress for a moment to tell you, I'll never forget a bit of testimony we had in the Foreign Relations Committee about 10 years ago when we found out that we were conducting a tremendous education program in a particular country. I thought that was great. I was heartened. I thought, at long last, we're really doing something. And then I found out the only reason that we were doing it is because everybody was so ignorant they couldn't use the weapons we'd sent. I found out that we were conducting a terrific nutrition program, marvelous nutrition program, great health program in this particular country. I found out the reason we were doing that is everybody was too sick to be able to man the machinery. It's true. Then I found out that after it was all over, they started using the guns against our best friends. That's a fact. You can figure out the country yourself. Now, arms control, therefore, in my mind, is a basic ingredient of the best medicine that is now available for a very sick patient. If the patient takes it and lives, then we may look forward to conquering the most brutal brace of diseases in the history of mankind, the twin diseases of war and poverty. And I want to touch briefly on some of the arguments that are being advanced against the formation of the Latin American denuclearized zone. Because you got to meet the opposition early. Never let them gain steam and gain speed on you. Early political lesson for any budding candidates out here. They need not detain us too long, however, these criticisms. First, there are those in Latin America who believe that Cuba must be a party to any denuclearized agreement, but who at the same time do not wish to dignify the Cuban government by sitting down at the same table with it. Now, these people cannot have it both ways. The Cuban government ought to be a party to any denuclearized treaty. I prefer a Cuban government that's free. And I have some ideas of how we organize a freedom campaign for Cuba, too, rather than just prophylactic action. But the threat of armed aggression from or by Cuba is the chief reason why Havana should be included and not excluded from participation. The United States does not seek arms control agreements with the Soviet Union because we like or trust its government. It is for exactly the opposite reason that we seek the arms control agreement. It is for this same reason that, despite my distaste for the government in communist China, I've always advocated communist China's early accession to a nuclear test ban and to a comprehensive disarmament agreement. I can't imagine anything more suicidal than agreeing to a disarmament program and excluding communist China. Yet we have people that hate the communists in China so much that they're perfectly willing to sign a disarmament agreement and keep China out because we don't want to sit down and talk to them. I've never been able to figure that one out unless they want to hand the world over to them. The people that need to be brought into an arms control and disarmament agreement are the potential aggressors, the bad boys, the evil ones. To get it in terms that everybody understands. I might add that it could even be possible that if that could be obtained or accomplished, that there could be a change of spirit in government in some of these countries. Now, a second argument against a denuclearized zone in Latin America is that it should be negotiated only within the framework of, that it should not be negotiated only within the framework of the Organization of American States, but rather in the United Nations. Now, that's one of those legalistic arguments that gets you nowhere. Frankly, I see no conflict here between the parent organization and a regional organization. Explicitly permitted under the UN Charter. All it amounts to is a chance for somebody to make another speech. Now, one frequently hears a third argument to the effect that the rivalries among certain Latin American countries would wreck any hope of a denuclearized zone agreement. Well, I'm here to report to you that there's some pretty serious rivalries in the Senate. As anyone would know who sat through the debate over the communications satellite bill this last summer. But in the Senate, we find that the best tack is often to start with the broad sponsorship of the bill or resolution after quiet exploration of all points of view beforehand. I suggest that this is a method which might yield some results in the context of the present discussion. Now, a fourth opposition argument is that some Latin American countries would not want to relinquish their right to receive nuclear weapons if the opportunity or to acquire them such ever presented itself. Now, of course, some countries look upon the possession of nuclear weapons as an indispensable attribute of their prestige. But let us not be taken in by this. There are other ways for a nation to acquire prestige, and we ought to start listing them. And I submit that two of these lie in promoting free and democratic political institutions and stable and expanding economy in concerts with one's neighbors. That's the prestige that Latin America needs. That's the prestige that the world needs. Perhaps the most cogent of all arguments against a Latin American denuclearized zone is either that it cannot be verified adequately or that the Latin American countries will refuse to accept verification. From the experience of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency to date, it is well known that verification system for any conceivable regional arms control agreement presents no insuperable obstacles. Political acceptability is a horse of another color. Technically, we can verify. Politically, we have our problems. But I go back again that in terms of aerial inspection, at least that's possible. Now, I see no reason why Latin America, however, should not be encouraged to be the leader in developing techniques and procedures for verifications of arms control agreements. The continent has already taken the lead in developing methods of solving disputes among the members of the region. A regional arms control agreement would be in keeping with the Latin American traditions of promoting peace, international cooperation, and observance of international law. A final argument is heard more from the outside of the hemisphere than inside it. This is a contention that a denuclearized zone in Latin America may inspire similar proposals for similar zones in other areas where it would not be in our national interest or in the interest of someone else to create such zones. Now, this is a poor argument that ought to be dismissed out of hand. We've never treated all regions alike in terms of national or regional security. Even in the days of Pactomania, we were careful to design each defense pact with special problems of the region in mind. There is no reason to treat the question of arms control any differently. Nuclear weapons are placed in the heart of Europe to counter the superior conventional strength of the Soviet Union. Nuclear weapons are close at hand in Southeast Asia to counteract the large manpower reserves of the Chinese communists. However, we should examine what kind of arms control measures might best serve the legitimate security interests of all countries in any region, as well as the countries outside the region which have commitments to help defend countries in the region against aggression. I, for one, I'm not worried that an effective Latin American denuclearized zone would adversely affect the security of Europe or Asia. I hope that the opposite would be true. Indeed, in the case of Africa, I can readily imagine an enthusiastic response to an appropriate arms control initiative by Latin America with the help and the encouragement of the United States. And I repeat that our foreign policy, our diplomacy, should emphasize these matters. We do not take this initiative, and I speak now not as a Democrat. I speak as an American citizen. I submit that the State Department, the government of this country, has failed in and out, Republican or Democrat, to take the initiative which is required in these regions to slow down this wasteful expenditure of arms. And we've got to tie this down by international agreement. Maybe this way we can slowly peel back the threat of the arms race. Now, before leaving this problem, and I'll just a moment on it, it is only fair to note that the creation of such a denuclearized zone would present certain problems to the United States. There might be the problem of armaments in the Panama Canal zone, of armaments en route through the Panama Canal to the east or the west coast of the United States or elsewhere, of armaments stationed at our Caribbean naval air bases, or armaments generally under the control of the Caribbean Sea frontier. But I would be greatly surprised, however, if these questions of particular interest to the United States should ever frustrate the will of the Latin American governments as expressed in the OAS. If the Latin American governments take the advanced political step of agreeing on a denuclearized zone, I am confident that the United States would make every reasonable adjustment in its policy so as to bring this agreement to fruition. Now, I've dwelled at particular length on the prospects for this denuclearized zone in Latin America. I've tried to make clear that I advocate this step from two overriding points of view. First, from the point of view of other countries and regions which might wish to follow suit. And second, from the point of view of a region which desperately needs to devote a maximum amount of its resources for developing economies that generally are in a pre-industrialized state, in which productivity is low and diversification almost nil. Here, the arguments in favor of a rational, adequately verified arms control agreement are compelling, and the same arguments pertain to Africa, to Asia, at least parts of Asia, and to the Middle East. We can approach this problem of regional or zonal arms control methodically, scientifically, carefully, in terms of security interests of ourselves and others. Instead of that, we keep spinning our wheels in trying to get some grandiose program exclusive of this limited approach. Now, Hubert Humphrey has been an advocate of general disarmament under proper security protections, verification, and inspection. And verification and inspection is not a way to delay it. It's a way to assure it, to ensure it. But I say that it is not a question of one or the other, all-out disarmament or regional arms control. I repeat, you can pursue both courses at the same time, And if you could ever get the example in any part of the world outside of the Antarctica, where human beings live, where there are natives outside of penguins, where you could have a disarmament or arms control agreement in a regional or zonal area, I think it would have a very decidedly good effect upon the whole subject of general and complete disarmament. That's my view of it. Now, if you'll bear with me, I'd like to talk a little bit about ourselves on the economic impact of disarmament. This may be slightly theoretical, but not necessarily. In the United States, as everyone who would here probably agree, disarmament and arms control are advocated for different reasons, and they raise different problems of implementation and adjustment than from those that I've spoken of earlier. For many years, we've had ample resources to continue a heavy armaments program. In fact, we could continue a much heavier one, and also to produce an abundance of products that the economy can use. In every study of the question thus far, there is convincing evidence that with proper planning and adjustments to arms control and disarmament present, that adjustments to arms control and disarmament present no insuperable difficulties. You're aware of the fact that the Senate Subcommittee on Disarmament conducted a very substantial and comprehensive study on this entire field. You're also aware of the fact that the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations wouldn't permit its publication, except as a confidential document, which I suppose I ought to be grateful for because most everybody's now read it. You get it classified just enough, you get enough people that get suspicious and want to read it. If we'd have made it general, I suppose it had just been filed away. I'd be interested in your views on the report that you've read, because I'm sure many of you have seen it. Why didn't we publish it? Because some people were afraid that it might give aid and comfort to the enemy. This kind of fear complex stands in the way of our greatness. Instead of being a manly nation with all of the virtues of a strong and a courageous and fearless people, we still act like immature adolescents. Now, I was rather surprised, and I might add pleased, that the first secretary of the Soviet embassy, who was with you, and I understand has been talking to a number of you, and you found him a very interesting gentleman, noted in his speech on Monday that recent studies published in the United States, quote, prove that general and complete disarmament is feasible from the point of view of the American economy, end of quote. Well, this ought to remove the classification restriction on that document of ours. Now, I'm highly gratified that the Soviet and the American negotiators now have the beginning of a common language when they approach the broader problems of disarmament. Unfortunately, the fact remains that whenever the United States undertook large-scale reductions of military hardware and personnel, which we have three times, or at least two times in our lifetime, in the lifetime of many of you, I see some that weren't around, it was quickly presented with the threat of new aggression. But let this be clear. We have disarmed, and we have done it twice within a period of 40 years. And we have been able to do it without serious dislocation of this economy. The only nations that have ever disarmed and proven that it could be done to the benefit of their economy and of their people were free nations, democratic nations. We've had experience in disarmament. Now, rearmament immediately ensued after these experiences, not because of the economics, not because of joblessness, not because of depression, but because of the threat of aggression. But I want to repeat, we've proven that you can disarm. And we've done it so quickly that the plans that are being made at Geneva look like plans for eternity. We did it in a few months, not over the years. We have a resiliency in this economy of ours that is incredible and unbelievable to the point where most people don't believe it. The trouble with American capitalism is that the capitalists don't believe in it enough. They don't talk about it enough. Good grief, they've got the best product in the world and they go around making apologies for it. The totalitarian's got a product that's been proven to be a failure and he goes around bragging about it. Oh, I'd like to get a hold of some of these fellows, and I plan on doing it. Now, the highly centralized totalitarian regimes, on the other hand, have never experienced voluntary disarmament. Maybe this is why they're so worried about it. They have never produced solely for peacetime consumption, never. Hitler never produced for it. Mussolini never produced for it. Tojo never produced for it. Stalin never produced for it. No totalitarian regime in the history of mankind has ever produced for peacetime consumption as the major objective of the state or of the system. The Soviet Union, regrettably, has pursued a tragic course through its 45 years of existence, intent upon building up its armed forces against either real or imaginary or imagined foes. It has chosen as the lesser evil a depressed standard of living for its people. And ladies and gentlemen, it may right now be at a point in human history where there's some rethinking in the Soviet Union. I hope so. I know there is some form of international intellectual ferment going on there. I believe there are people in the Soviet Union today who, on the one hand, feel that they ought to have an all-out arms race. If they have it with us, they can't win. Be sure of that. We have the resources to outproduce them at any stage in the foreseeable future. If it is an arms race that they want, we ought to assure them that it is one they'll lose, so that the diehards, the hardheads, will understand it unequivocally. We didn't do that for a long time. We sort of gave them an arms race in the 50s that was cheap enough for us to enjoy and just low enough so that they could survive. Now, I'm not advocating that course, but I say it is an alternative which could be pursued with risk, but there's risk in anything. Now, the other possibility is that at this very moment in the Soviet Union, there may well be men in positions of responsibility who are wondering whether or not they ought not to give a try to a higher standard of living. Could be. This will require the most delicate type of probing and exploration. I'm not prepared to say unequivocally just what is the situation because I'm not that wise. But I am prepared to make the study, prepared to try to find out. I repeat that no totalitarian society to date has ever tried to produce for peacetime consumption. Possibly Mr. Khrushchev and some of his people around him, in light of the rift between in the Sino-Soviet bloc, are beginning to ask some questions as to whether or not an arms race is the manner in which they should pursue their objectives. And if that's the case, then we ought to be prepared by intellectual exercise, by plan, by program, by science and technology, by every means that we have, by study of human behavior, to see whether or not there is any possibility in reducing the thrust of this arms race, of cutting it back. This is why I supported the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, not because I thought it would bring about arms control and disarmament now or in the immediate next week or next year or next 2 or 3 years, but because I thought it was time that we mobilize the intellectual resources of this country for peace and for a peace that's meaningful and not just a peace that's off here in the ether someplace. Therefore, in both countries, in both economic systems, there may well be, because we've had to rearm so often and because the Soviets have always maintained a program of armament, there's possibly an ingrained inertia or just an ingrained bad habit which has to be overcome. Possibly there are groups in both societies which are afraid of the dislocation of shifting priorities, which will be the hallmarks of the immediate post-arms race era. I myself have never subscribed to the notion either that our economy depends on defense spending or that powerful groups in this American economy oppose disarmament because it would bring financial loss and unemployment. I don't buy that argument. Nevertheless, I have detected some uneasiness in some groups and people representing some areas whenever these subjects are mentioned. With automation proceeding at a fast pace and causing dislocations, Among the unskilled and the untrained, every lagging element of the economy has a harmful effect in the absence of prompt and effective corrective measures. Moreover, the United States defense establishment has now become so concentrated that some individuals, some communities, areas, and companies are all too dependent on a continuation of defense contracts. Since I remain convinced that with proper planning by government, industry, labor, and the communities involved, these adjustment problems can be met and solved, and they have been met even without planning. We're a lucky people. The time has come to remove whatever economic uneasiness remains. I've said a number of times that one of the great shortcomings in this country is the unwillingness of people to permit planning or even the statement of goals. People don't know what we're for because we don't. People don't know what we plan ahead because we don't know. We've had such a freedom of choice that nobody's gotten around to decide what to choose. I think it's time that the government of the United States, in consultation with industry and labor and the communities affected, started to make some plans to have not only war plans, but peace plans. No reason that we shouldn't. Both the executive and the legislative branches of our government have been derelict in not sitting down to study these problems in detail. And the hopeful studies that Mr. Karpoff mentioned are extremely useful, but they are no substitutes for the exhaustive work that is required. With detailed studies and plans, I am confident that any doubts about our ability to adjust favorably to a disarmament or arms control program, if one could be negotiated with safety, can be shown to be groundless. We must overcome our reluctance to plan ahead. At the same time, I fully agree with Mr. Arthur Barber, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Arms Control, if I understand his message, that planning is a joint venture and not merely a matter of government alone. Now, one of the main reasons why studies of the economic adjustments to arms control are needed now is that some of these adjustments will require substantial innovations. I mentioned, for example, the research dollar. What are we going to do about that? And I want to repeat that I think this is our major economic threat in the next decade. The failure to properly allocate the research dollar. I think we're going to pay for it. I think we're going to lose business. I think we're going to have unemployment. I think we're going to lose markets because we haven't allocated the defense dollar. We'll become a Sparta without preparing ourselves, without recognizing that the real strength of the American security system is in its economy. In its economy and the broad diversification of that economy. Now let me illustrate. Many defense companies are basically commercially oriented, even with large defense contracts. They grew up serving a market where the customer was king and they're familiar with competition. They'll do all right. Under the arms control situation, these companies can be counted on to renew their concentration on the commercial market. They would undoubtedly get into new lines of products, expand abroad, increase production of regular commercial items in high demand. And even in the event of a loss of military contracts, their main problem of adjustment would be making a smooth transition from defense to commercial projects, and surely government could aid in this. Their experience would be essentially a repetition of the adjustment which many companies underwent following the Korean War. Many other defense companies, however, have little or no experience with commercial sales. Created almost solely to fill defense contracts, they are not commercially oriented, and their genius has lain in amassing impressive intellectual talent and resourcefulness to solve major technical and developmental problems associated with the missile or the nuclear age. Such companies could not easily be left to sink or swim in the free marketplace. In fact, the entire management of these companies is geared to serving only one, and in the best of circumstances, only a few customers. Therefore, thank goodness, there are not many of these companies, but their size is tremendous. And I submit that about the 15 largest of them receive some 45% of the entire defense procurement, research and development allocations of the government, and I might add that they're not very well geographically distributed either. If anybody doesn't get that, let me repeat it. They're not very well geographically distributed either. Which doesn't make much sense from a defense point of view, if not an economic point of view, and surely politically very unwise. I don't happen to believe that one of the other seacoast has a monopoly upon either weather or brains. What is more, in my part of the country, it's cold, and I gather the Russians have some rather cold climate, too. In other words, I'm using as my source information collected from a recent study conducted by my Senate Subcommittee on Disarmament. About 15 companies did over $10 billion worth of defense work in 1959. They're doing substantially more now. Moreover, they did little or no commercial business on the side. Now, what are you going to do about these if and when you get any form of arms control or disarmament? If these companies are geared to serving only a few customers, then a large part of the answer is to create a few new customers to substitute for the loss of defense work. Where might such customers come from? In what fields of endeavor, other than the commercial market? Might these companies find a welcome need for their talents? I think a few possibilities could be mentioned. First, there's space. The space effort will expand greatly in the coming years. I don't believe many of us appreciate how greatly it will expand. You can expect within by 5 years a space program of not less than $25 to $30 billion and maybe more. That's a minimum estimate. Planets such as Venus and Mars will enjoy far less privacy in the years ahead than they enjoy today. Already there is keen competition between the civilian requirements for space exploration and the military demands for better and more reliable vehicles of destruction. And might I add to my civilian and military friends, you're not kidding anybody, there is this competition. I had a prominent civilian space scientist who served in two administrations come to see me a few months ago, and he tipped me off. He says, "You can expect, Senator, a considerable amount of publicity in the months ahead about the importance of the space operation being taken over by the Air Force." And how right he was. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think the Air Force has a place in it, but I don't think the military ought to own it. I believe that basically the National Aeronautical and Space Agency ought to be fortified and strengthened, that the military ought to have its role. But in line with the Atomic Energy Commission, it ought to be essentially a civilian program with the military taking on the special aspects that are required for the defense of the nation. And there ought not to be an either-or, as some people would like to pose it. Time will tell whether the unsatisfied demands of NASA and Telstar and the like will ever take precedence over the legitimate necessity for improved military space technology. I've expressed my point of view on that. But in any event, there are too many unmet needs on Earth to have all of these resources directed outside our atmosphere. Now, a second area is atomic energy. Today, over 17 years after the first nuclear explosions in World War II, the then heralded peaceful applications of nuclear energy have still not proven economically feasible. Why has there been only one NS Savannah, nuclear ship Savannah? One of the reasons I would suggest is that a concentrated effort to develop widespread peaceful uses for atomic energy has had a comparatively low priority. With the elimination of overriding defense needs, the peaceful application of nuclear energy should rank high among the tasks to be assigned for our defense-oriented industry. And finally, thirdly, there is the area of water. I might say to my scientist friends that it just seems to me that instead of trying to find out how dry it is on the moon, why don't you find out how to put some water on the soil? Or do both. Every place I've gone, there's nothing but sand and rock and dust. And we're pouring in billions of dollars of American capital, and they haven't got any water. They haven't even got a well. They can't even take a bath. Seems to me that a concentrated program on the study of water supply, or converting seawater into potable water, into sweet water, not just a little half-baked effort, but a tremendous effort, would produce results. I predict that the nation that can convert seawater into sweet water first will be the most powerful nation on the face of the earth for the next century or half century. Even more important than seeing who gets to that moon. I gather that's going to be interesting, and I'd like to see us get there first. But I'll tell you, if you could get to the Sahara Desert first with water, you'd beat everybody. You've just witnessed the danger of having a layman talk to you on scientific matters. But one of the troubles is about the, or one of the needs, I think, in a society is that we tell the scientists what to do and not let them tell us what to do. I'll never forget what Henri Spock had to say about the common market. He listened to all the lawyers for 5 years, and they told him what you couldn't do. Just couldn't be done. You couldn't do this, couldn't do that. Tradition wouldn't permit it. International law wouldn't permit it. Sovereignty wouldn't permit it, etc. So he and the Dutch foreign minister got together one day, and they called in the expert and said, "Now look, old chums, we have decided on a common market. You figure out how to do it." That's how they got the common market. A year ago, just last month, Henri Spaak told me this very story. "I think it's about time that we called in some of the scientists and said, look, we've decided we want to do something." That's what they did in World War I or World War II about the atomic bomb. Maybe we ought to decide something else for a change. I think if we decided we wanted some water, there's a lot of it around. 3/5 of the surface of the globe is made up of it, and the last of the other 2/5, 1/5 is arid. Now, not only is there a problem of water in other parts of the world, but in the United States. Floods wreak their destruction in some areas. There are water shortages in others. Disputes over water have created grave political problems between nations, one right now between Mexico and the United States. All of this suggests to me that one of the current needs in the world is the creation of an international water development authority. I do not care particularly whether this is one institution or whether it consists of regional institutions. But if the major regions decided to make a massive assault on all-out water problems and could utilize the genius of some of our big defense scientists, which have been geared to meet and solve such difficult problems, we could be solving two big problems in a most satisfactory way: the adjustment of the problems of big defense contractors and the water problems of many scattered regions of the world. Now, I shan't outline this in any more detail. I'd merely add this. I attended the World's Fair at Seattle. I saw what we called Century 21 exhibit. I saw what we could do with our scientific talent if once we ever had a chance. How we could remake our cities. How we could literally remake our educational system. What we could do in terms of communication, roads, ports, rivers, development, telecommunications. What we could do in terms of our libraries and automation, retrieval of information, automatic translations. Ladies and gentlemen, if we had but the will, if ever we could get a program of arms control under verification, or of disarmament under inspection and verification, there are unlimited possibilities. One of the great tragedies is we've never been able to fully dramatize what those possibilities are, except in the most general terms. This is a limitation upon us. We've never been able to dramatize, it seems to me, even what we're trying to do in a limited program like the Alliance for Progress. We've got bankers that announce loans, but we never have anybody that announces what the loans will buy. We say we loan $100 million to country X, and most everybody feels that half of it will be wasted, a quarter of it will be stolen, and nobody knows what will really happen with the money. It seems to me that what we ought to do is to announce that we've arrived at an agreement with country X to build X number of thousand homes, to rehabilitate 1 million acres, to build schools for 2 million children, to provide so many job opportunities, and let somebody else announce how big the loan was. It seems to me that even as we discuss the economic aspects of disarmament, we ought to face up to the fact that all of this is impossible unless there's a political decision backed up by science and technology, a political agreement. But what if there were a political agreement? What would be the end result? Or better yet, how do you get a political agreement unless you start to outline what could be the end result if you could get the political agreement? If we could once convince the mass of humanity that if leadership in nations could be brought to a sensible understanding of the possibilities of a world living without an arms race, I have a feeling that if we could ever get that message across to humanity, it would have some effect even in the most restricted of countries. Don't misunderstand me. I'm a political realist. I know that a totalitarian regime has a very limited public opinion. But even the totalitarian regime is not immune. At least it is an effort worthwhile. This is why I've often believed that the behavioral aspects of arms control and disarmament ought to be more emphasized. I believe this, and I believe that more than just the science and the technological aspects need to be emphasized. I happen to believe that when you see gatherings like this, that there's reason for hope. Now, some people may say that this is untimely to maximize the economic and social benefits accrued. accruing to a world firmly at peace. This is not the same as counting chickens before they hatch. I like to think of it, rather, as the adventuresome spirit of foresight which distinguished our nation in past decades, of having the dream based upon some reality of the possibilities of a world at peace and of a world at least that's in balance. And that possibility ought to be something that we outline to the world and not leave it to others. Thank you.